the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning we speak with local resident Chris Fisher. He's the founder and expedition leader of OSearch. Chris joins to talk about some upcoming expeditions to explore and study sharks in the Mediterranean Sea near Spain and France.
And then it was just last week, the second anniversary of the James Webb Space Telescope science operations. We're joined by NASA astronomer Dr. Christine Chen, who joins the show to share some of Webb's latest discoveries, including some fascinating images that we'll also share on our website, kpcw.org. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
The organization OSearch was founded by our next guest, Chris Fisher, a local Park City resident whose mission it is to solve the global white shark puzzle and return our world's oceans to balance and abundance. We check in with Chris regularly on Cool Science Radio when he's in town for, 10 minutes. This morning he talks to us about the newest expedition in the Mediterranean. Chris, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's always great to have you because it's so fun to talk about the work that you're doing and also to feel the passion with which you approach everything you do with OSearch. Let's say some of our listeners don't know what OSearch is. Can you give an overview?
Yeah, I think OSearch, really organically evolved with my work starting on the water in the late 90s. We were doing a lot of big game fishing, making TV shows for ESPN Outdoors, and I started to assist the scientists that studied things like marlin, different species of marlin, sailfish, and other things, because what we saw was the scientists, they study and they get their degrees, and then they're kind of sent out into the world, and they're trained to be a scientist, but then suddenly they have to learn how to be a fisherman and operate a boat so that they can actually catch what they study, and they have no idea how to do that. And because of that, we lack the data to manage our oceans toward abundance. If you talk to anybody in the ocean space and say, what's the number one problem? They will say data deficit. Mm-hmm. We lacked the data to make decisions to manage species back. So I was really seeing tremendous success helping those scientists because, they might be trying to put out 20 tags with their intern on a 20-foot boat for 5 years, and we could take them out on one 12-day shoot and tag 20 animals for them in 12 days because we knew how to operate on the water and we knew how to catch. So we saw this tremendous commonsensical power of bringing together different skill sets around a common vision. And in the past, the scientists and the fishermen, there was distrust and, they didn't really, weren't coming together for our grandkids. So I saw that the system is broken. The reason why we have data deficit problems is because the actual ocean research academic system is broken. It hasn't changed since for 100 years, right? Publish or perish forces the scientists into individual silos instead of big collaborative teams. So I'm helping all these scientists study billfish, and they just stop in the middle of this. We're down in Central America, and they're like, hey, Chris, we're down to 9% of our large sharks. And if we don't bring our large sharks back, this offshore adventures life that you enjoy and you want your kids to enjoy, to be able to travel around and fish and free dive and eat food, will not exist if we can't bring the sharks back.
Right.
And that kind of stunned me. That was like 2006. And I was like, what's the deal? It's like they're so big that no scientists around the world have been able to actually study them, figure out where they mate, give birth, their full range, what they eat, so that we can actually help them recover. Because if we can bring our large sharks back, we bring the whole system back with them because they are the wolf, they are the lion, the apex predator. So I really kind of just looked around the world at the time, and my noble goal before starting Offshore Adventures was to pour the world's oceans into people's lives at a scale unseen since Cousteau. I've been chasing Cousteau since, the late 90s.
Really?
When he passed, I felt like the ocean lost its voice, and there was no one there really to step in the middle to kind of drown out or pull in the fringes so we could make practical progress. So I started with a fishing show. That was normal. Saw an opportunity to help the science. Then these scientists came to us with this massive global problem. Chris, there's 9 populations of white sharks. We don't know how to manage any of them back because they're so big. If you could help us do that, you would make a global impact on ocean abundance. And I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting to me.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's where it began. You know, I'm not a shark guy. The sharks found us. I'm an abundance person. I think Captain Brett McBride on the ship would say the same thing. We want to make sure that when families go to the ocean, they see an ocean full of fish. And in order to do that, we got to bring our large sharks back.
So enter this crazy ocean-worthy vessel that OSearch owns. And this is how, with this platform that goes down into the water, you can actually tag a great white shark. Which, how much does the average great white shark weigh, and how does that go?
Well, the large sharks we deal with are in the 4,000 pound range.
Wow.
But, you know, regularly dealing with them anywhere from like 400 to 2,000 pounds. Occasionally you'll see a bigger one, but the lift is capable of lifting up much more weight than that. Yeah, but the lift, so what do you have? You have, we're bringing together the street smarts and the book smarts around the right equipment to do what everyone said was impossible. And when you do that, it's like not that hard. It's really just about funding it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that's not happening everywhere in the ocean space. So what we're doing is at OSearch, we're a beacon of light. We're learning 30 to 50 times faster than the normal science group you would fund at in a university or whatever. And we want to be the new way. We're demonstrating you can bring the fishermen and the scientists together, close the knowledge gap. Pretty general knowledge in the ocean space that the fishermen are 30 years ahead of the scientists in understanding what's going on. So why not bring those communities together and quickly close that gap in when your challenge is data deficit?
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is no-brainer stuff if you work in the for-profit space, but in the academic nonprofit world, it's like groundbreaking.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are joined by Chris Fisher. He was a Park City local and also the founder and expedition leader of OSearch, tracking sharks around the world. Well, Chris, you know, this idea of the data deficit disorder, you see that in so many research areas. And I think what's so great about what you do, like you just said, it's you create a solution space. You're bringing in the scientists and the fishermen and the aquatics people. What are they doing with all of that data? I can only imagine the amounts of data and the data that you're bringing in. So you've got the scientists bringing in all this great data. How are the fishermen able to use it? Because not everyone can understand that scientific data.
Yeah, so the data comes in and then it goes through a peer-reviewed publication process. We have over 92 peer-reviewed papers now, and they just keep going up, up, up. Those papers are then used to drive policy, right? We open source the data with everyone in real time. So everyone can follow OSearch, you know, on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or the YouTube channel. And you can follow and see the data in real time. So we share it with the public, which was kind of like back in 2012 when we started doing that, it was like groundbreaking. It's you know, and now everyone's used to it and it's the way it should be. So the public is involved with it. So they know what's going on, what's shaping up, what are we learning in real time. And then the papers publish. And then if you need to drive policy, you leverage those on Capitol Hill, which we have great relationships up there as well. And it's pretty smooth, you know, is what the big challenge in this particular area is when you do go up to Capitol Hill and you're trying to drive some sort of centrist, data-driven, practical policy, you get these fringe groups that are not solution-oriented, that are position-oriented, and the poachers are just as bad as the preservationists. The preservationists, I'd say, you know, they're all just stuck in their spot, so you can't bring people together. So one of the reasons we drive all that big public outreach and inclusion is now we have become much, much bigger than them. Our constituency base is bigger, and our constituency base is built up of primarily normal people, you know, that are just want to have an abundant ocean and be able to raise their kids and look after their life. And so because of that, we're seeing and creating more and more inertia in the middle so that we can try to pull those fringes in and actually make these kind of centrist practical steps forward.
Well, what other, so, you know, you talk about Capitol Hill, our Capitol Hill, the U.S. Are there policies being formulated in other countries thanks to your data?
Yeah, we've done a lot of work in other countries. The last 7 years or so, we've been focused on the East Coast of the United States, which is the beacon of light for the world and recovering an ocean. We have more life off our East Coast right now than we've seen since the 1940s. It's been rewilded. Our Pacific Coast is teeming with life as well, just a few years behind it due to excellent management moves over the last 30 years. So we've been focused on that winning. We need to transfer what we've done now to show other people how much you can really make an impact in 20 or 30 years. Prior to that, we did a lot of work getting the foreign longlining fleet removed from Panama, work in various other countries as we've moved around the world that's inspired different policies. So another thing that makes OSearch unique, you got to understand, I came in, I'm an entrepreneur, right? I studied international business at Indiana University and the National University of Singapore. Grew up a passionate fisherman, tried to turn that into my profession, and that's what's kind of driving all of these things. And so when I came in, you know, people used to say you can only do science, and then you have to sit that on a shelf, and some other group that's involved in policy has to come, and if they're interested, maybe they can leverage it to do policy. And I'm like, wait a minute, our challenge is data deficit and affecting policy with the data that we don't have. We need to get the data, then we need to drive it. So what makes OSearch very unique is we're working so hard to generate this money to pay for the ship because we give the ship to the scientists. They have no boats and no money. You know, that when we create that new data, we have very disciplined science agreements with our scientists. You know, they must perform with that data and write their papers or it will be given to someone else and it will be published because we're spending millions of dollars providing them a ship. So they need to provide papers in a timely manner, and then we take those papers to Capitol Hill ourselves. So again, totally different. We are from the data creation all the way to the policy. In the old way, that journey is chopped up into three different organizations. Great science gets left on the shelf, and it's not efficient.
Right.
It's not the way you do it if it was a for-profit business. You were trying to just be efficient. So that's all we've done is create a really efficient method of overcoming data deficit.
Something I've never asked you, Chris, how big is your staff at OSearch?
Very small. The staff at OSearch is made up of about five people, you know, three scientists, two people who work hard in communications, and then maybe a few other people that I kind of donate to OSearch from. I have another small business called Fisher Productions making TV shows for Discovery about cars, bitchin' rides and stuff. So I can kind of use Fisher Productions and I can use some of that staff to help the nonprofit.
Right, right. Okay. So you don't specifically have policy experts who know how to go, you know, take this stuff to Capitol Hill and say, you know.
Oh, well, my senior science advisor, Dr. Bob Huter, well, he goes with me sometimes. And my chief scientist, Dr. Harley Newton, you know, they advise me. And then we have a group we work with in D.C. that we've been working with for a long time who gets the meetings. And then you got to understand one great thing about our work is when we're working particularly off the East Coast, all the policymakers, if they can, they want to come out on the ship. So we regularly have senators and congressmen out on the ship. And what's really powerful then is you have the fishermen, the scientists, the policymakers. We'll have our educators there, the communicators there, right? And so
breaking down the silos.
What we're doing is we're compressing time, right? If all of these people are in it during the field work instead of reading a paper that comes out 5 years later, they know what's going on. They see it coming. The paper pops. The policy's ready.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk about some upcoming expeditions. It seems like every time we've spoken to you, it's been the Eastern Seaboard from like Cape Cod up to Newfoundland, and it's so rich in great whites, right? But now the Mediterranean, Spain, France,
yeah,
Italy,
you know, it's time.
Ireland.
We've had. So there's 9 white shark populations around the world, and their life history puzzle has never been solved in any one of them, and we just completed it off our East Coast for the first time in history. So we now can manage our white sharks off the East Coast. We are in control of our destiny when it comes to abundance now. Data deficit is no longer the challenge. In the midst of all of that, our East Coast is teeming with life. I mean, it has been rewilded. Literally to levels we haven't seen in 80 years. But if you go to the western North Atlantic, just across the way, it is not the same story. The Med is dead is pretty much common language now. Well, I refuse to accept that. I don't care that it's over there. Because if the Med is dead, that's going to affect Western Europe. That's going to affect Western Africa. And at some point, with our coast teeming with life, they're going to come for our fish. They're going to come for food. So we got to get them going in the right direction just to help ourselves in the long play. And so we're going over there to try to solve the puzzle of the Mediterranean white shark. We're taking everything we've learned from 46 expeditions around the world. It's going to be by far the hardest thing we've ever tried. But if we can bring the Mediterranean white shark back and we open source that to the continent and they get involved the way the East Coast of the United States has in the journey with the open source of the data, we'll have a big microphone. And we will leverage that to try to inspire the continent to bring the Med back. I oftentimes, when I'm thinking at home in the backyard here, I'm thinking like, well, I'm taking the ship over there. We're going to go over there. We're going to solve the white shark puzzle. That's what we do. That's just a matter of if we can, how much time and money we have. Because the system works, right? We've been cranking it out. I'm going over there to inspire a continent.
Nice. Well, Chris, let's talk about the technology behind this. I'm assuming it's not just a simple tracker that we've heard about over the years. Are you, in addition to the scientists and the policymakers and the fishermen, are you working with technology developers to help create newer and better tracking systems?
We are, yeah. That's slow going in that space, in the ocean space, because there's just no volume for the manufacturers. You know, it doesn't really drive the latest technology. The other thing is, I think that people really underestimate that don't work on the ocean is how brutal the salt water in the ocean is on anything. So it's very, very difficult to get, you know, any of these new ultralight modern type of systems mounted on an animal and have it actually hold up for any period of time to get you the data set you're looking for. That being said, we are using the latest and greatest stuff, but some of that would surprise you in the ocean space compared to the latest and greatest stuff you use on land.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we use three different types of tags on the sharks. One is what everyone follows on the Global Shark Tracker, and then a couple other ones that give us different data sets to round out understanding their movements.
So let's go back to how the sharks, an increase in the population of sharks, what does that reflect going on literally under the water that shows you that the ocean is healing?
Well, you can see it just with everything else that's going on. Like you see stories now coming out of Long Island, like what's going on? There's all this bait on the beach and then the sharks frenzy on it. Well, that's used to go on all the time, right? When you got a lot of bait, the game fish and the sharks push it against the beach. They crowd it against the beach, and then they just go for it because it's easier to catch them. It's just that our oceans have been so depleted, nobody had been able to see that since 1940.
Wow.
You know, so we're starting to see this from throughout the Gulf and our entire East Coast. The West Coast fishing is electric as well. And that's basically because as the sharks return, you got to think of them like a conductor of an orchestra. They keep every instrument in tune. For example, when they move up to the northeastern United States and there's a lot of seals on the beaches, if white sharks are present, if they're swimming up and down the beach, they will keep all of those seals pinned down, stuck up out of the water until they're really, really hungry. And then they just get a little bit and they jump back out. We know that when white sharks are present, all of those seals eat 1/4 as much per day. If those seals aren't there, they wipe out the stripers, the cod, the lobster, everything else. And because of the huge success we've had with the Marine Mammal Protection Act we passed 55 years ago to bring back the whales and the seals, is now really gaining momentum. Like, we've saved our whales and seals. It's over. I mean, they're back. There are a few species that are coming back slower that are of concern, like the northern right whale. But generally speaking, like, check. Our whales are back, our seals are back, our turtles are back, they're back. And so that really began the momentum. And now that we're seeing this tremendous recovery of the seals, like there used to be no seals in Cape Cod. When we went in 2012 and tagged the very first sharks in the Western Atlantic, there was a few seals off Cape Cod. That was just like 12, 14 years ago. Now, it's the seal population has made its way all the way down into the Jersey mainland and into making it down into the mid-Atlantic region. And the historic range of the gray seal goes all the way down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. So if our white sharks aren't coming back, those seals are going to decimate our fish stocks, and there will be nothing for us to eat. Mm-hmm. When you go into like a reef type situation, when you think of a reef, if you understand the story of the wolf in Yellowstone, mm-hmm. and you look at these fixed reef areas, when white sharks come through there, they force everything to behave the way it's supposed to maximize the abundance of that reef. The little fish that pick at the reef, they have to hide half the day. They can't pick at the reef 24 hours a day. So the reef comes back, the coral comes back, everything comes back, right? So as the mountain lion moves through the forest here in our beautiful, beautiful mountains, we're so lucky to live here. Everything when that mountain lion moves through knows it's there. And everything behaves as if it's there, which puts it in perfect tune with the orchestra. And that is what the white shark does as well.
Mm, wow. One of the things you do and have done, and I don't know how widespread it is, but I think going into our schools and educating young people is what we have to do when we want to educate the world, basically. Number one, you have the app, the Shark Tracker app. And if any of our listeners don't know what that is, just go to the App Store and download the OSearch Shark Tracker. It's so much fun to look at. How are you going to go about along the Mediterranean educating young people in, you know, France and Spain?
Well, we sure hope our American students come along for the ride who've been in, you know, with homeschool, our educational curriculum has just exploded, right? We have a full K through 12 STEM-based curriculum that's integrated to the movements of the sharks and the turtles on the app. We just completely updated and are launching all updated lesson plans. There's over 100 of them that'll be coming out before this school year here this August. And then obviously as we move over there, we got to make sure that the metric system is integrated into it and we start creating the appropriate languages for those places. We have special packets in different languages for each expedition for homeschoolers to follow. Like, we're getting ready to start an 8-week expedition at the end of July over in Europe. And there are STEM packets at osearch.org. If you go to programs and education, it's just all free and downloadable. And you can actually do STEM packets that are directly associated with our expedition we're currently on, and then the ongoing curriculum. So yeah, I would encourage anyone to do that. It's, you know, based off real data that we're learning in real time and applied to these kids, learning that when it comes their time to be an ocean steward, it's an unemotional journey. It's about data, and it's about math, and that's it. And so we want our future resource managers to kind of come up with that disposition, not some highly emotional environmentalist, you know, that you can't really talk data to so you can come to a solution. That's a real problem. So, you know, if your kids come to OSearch, they're going to be looking at the ocean in a more scientific, centrist, data-driven way.
Mm. I'm sensing that you have heard a lot from those people. A few minutes ago, you talked about people on the fringes. You're talking about the emotionalism of the environmental movement at times. How can we heal ourselves? How can we fix ourselves from going down those rabbit holes?
Well, I think by understanding that the answer is always in the middle, and you're not going to get everything you want, but if you move toward a positive trajectory, then that's a good step at that moment, right? You got to get all these different user groups coming together. And in order to do that, not everybody's going to get everything they want. But if you can come together and get things that make the overall ocean situation improve, then that's a good step forward. So the position-oriented people that are all or nothing are preventing these sort of small incremental centrist movements that over time we see tremendous results from. So that's why you, look, man, I'm just trying to make sure we deliver an ocean full of fish to our kids. And so anybody who's got some silly emotional disposition that's going to prevent that sort of trajectory or progress, I got a real problem with. And I'm not going to have any problem telling them that because there's no more time. And we're talking about our kids. So now I'm going to a whole new level of intensity. I'm going to take a drink of water and a deep breath.
Well, while you do that, Chris, your description of an apex predator being the conductor of a symphony, I think is one of the best descriptions I've ever heard and one of the best reasons for why we need these. How can, so you're on the ocean, but we're here in the West, Yellowstone, wolves, bears, all these other predators that are being reintroduced, and there's so much pushback. You know, people making a living, people afraid. What, in the last couple few minutes we have, how can we approach the people around us or in this area to really teach them that these predators are important?
Well, I think it is very commonsensical if someone slows down and helps people kind of get it. You know, but you're talking about a couple of different choices when it comes to these apex predators. You know, we can either choose to have abundant levels of apex predators in any system that you love or care about and deliver abundance to our children, or we can get rid of them and maybe they don't have enough food. That's pretty much the choices.
Pretty much the choices. And I think people need to understand, again, this is an entire system, a very complex system that relies on all of these pieces.
Of course. Like here, like if you like to hunt, if you like to fish, our apex predators are affecting every single one of those systems. You know, like, for example, they knew, when the wolf was gone out of Yellowstone, the forest couldn't come back, the beavers weren't there, there were no swamps because the deer and elk could graze 24 hours a day. The forest could never come back. Yeah. They move the wolf in, they got to go to sleep and hide all the day, the whole thing comes back, the aggregate abundance explodes. Same deal in the ocean.
Yeah. It's OCEARCH, OCEARCH.org. Our guest is local resident Chris Fisher. He's the founder and expedition leader at OCEARCH, heading off to save the Med. The Med is not dead.
I sure hope not.
Spain and France, July 29th through August 27th, and then an expedition in Ireland, September 2nd to 23rd. Chris, thank you so much for your time this morning. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hey, I'd like to really encourage everybody. We're giving away a trip for someone to come over on the ship in Europe, and it's at meetashark.com. So nice. Please go to meetashark.com and enter the sweepstakes. You can help us with a small donation when you do that or not, but we want to get as many people involved as we can in that. Thanks for having me.
The James Webb Space Telescope launched 2.5 years ago, and in that time has captured images of space that have allowed scientists and even the casual observer to uncover some mysteries of space. Unlike the Hubble Space Telescope, it doesn't orbit around the Earth, it orbits around the Sun and is 1 million miles away. July 12th marked the second anniversary of James Webb's science operations, and what better way to celebrate than with a new stellar image of the universe? Here to talk about this newly released image and some of Webb's latest discoveries is NASA expert Dr. Christine Chen. Dr. Chen is the Space Telescope Science Institute astronomer, and in her research, studies things like space dust and exoplanets. Dr. Chen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Of all the images that we have seen in the last couple years from James Webb, what has excited you the most?
Oh my gosh, JWST has been such an amazing producer of gorgeous images of the universe on all different scales. I personally am really interested in how planetary systems form and evolve. And so my favorite images, of course, sort of revolve around that area. Within the past 6 months, there's been a really beautiful image that appeared in the New York Times of a nearby star called Fomalhaut and the discovery of an asteroid belt around that system for the very first time. Another image that has happened recently is that of a planetary system that's only 60 light years away, Beta Pictoris, and the discovery of a filament-like structure, which is due to massive collisions of asteroids in the outer part of the solar system. So I would have to say that those two are my favorite.
Oh, that's wonderful. So if you look back at, you know, previous to two years ago when James Webb started capturing images of the universe, how different was it? You know, what you were looking at from the Hubble Space Telescope, or, you know, even some of the strong, really powerful telescopes around the globe that you've probably been able to look through. What stands out as like the biggest distinction to you?
Oh, there's many, which maybe is not helpful. But so the really power of jadeweed tea is that it has a large aperture, so it has a big mirror, and it's in space, so it's very sensitive. And we just really win at infrared wavelengths. So we have comparable size telescopes on the ground that are also like 6.5 to 8 meters. But you know, those telescopes are not in space, and so we have to look through the atmosphere. And the atmosphere creates all sorts of problems in the infrared. So, for example, the infrared sky is bright, and so it's hard to see through it because the whole thing glows at, you know, about 300 degrees Kelvin. It's just really revolutionized our ability to study the universe because we can make such sensitive measurements in the infrared. The previous space-based mission before this one was the Spitzer Space Telescope, you know, for the comparable infrared wavelengths. And that one was much smaller. It was only 85 centimeters compared to 6.5 meters for JWST. And because JWST is so much larger, it has much better ability to see fine detail in the pictures that it takes. And it's also much more sensitive because you can think of as the telescope as a giant light bucket. And the bigger the bucket, the more light you collect.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Dr. Christine Chen. She is with NASA, and she is the James Webb Space Telescope Science Institute astronomer. And we are talking about the new image that they have released on July 12th. Well, Dr. Chen, we were talking about favorite images, and one of mine is of the Pillars of Creation. And I was looking at the updated image online, and the new images from James Webb as compared to Hubble, there is so much more depth and it's such a 3D nature. What has all of this extra data from James Webb taught us about the Pillars of Creation?
Absolutely. So in the infrared, you have a couple sort of superpowers compared to like maybe the images we're used to with Hubble Space Telescope. One of them is the ability to peer through dust and to see into the hearts of dusty star-forming regions. And so the Pillars of Creation is one of my favorite images too. But there what you see are, you know, these fingers that come down, and at the tips of them, there are stars that are forming, and there's a nearby star and its radiation is blowing dust and gas away. But it is hard in the Hubble images to really peer into the depths of where the star formation is happening because it's enshrouded in dust and gas. And so when you shift to the infrared wavelengths, for example, with JWST, you're able to peer through that dust and gas and see to the very heart, to where those baby stars are forming.
Well, James Webb is going to provide all of us with so much amazing data and images over the next lifespan, or over its lifespan. What are some of the main goals of James Webb? Like, what do you really hope to learn from its mission?
Absolutely. So as you said, JWST, it's performing absolutely wonderfully. And we expect it to continue to observe the universe for many, many more years. My personal interest is understanding how planetary systems form and evolve. And one of the outstanding questions that I think that we have is, how does water become incorporated into our terrestrial planets? Because we think that water is really important for the development of life in the universe. And so JWST gives us access to diagnostics with water. And so I've been using JWST, and I hope to continue using JWST, to understand where water is in planetary systems, how it gets into the terrestrial planet zone. And the whole idea is to try to understand whether our solar system is common or rare, you know, whether or not these planetary systems have water that looks like our solar system's water.
That's pretty exciting. I mean, this is one of the big roles that James Webb Space Telescope is playing now to also to study every phase of our history, which is a kind of a loaded thing to study, right? From the Big Bang to the present. And then to also, as you say, maybe discover where, give us better clues into where there may be life based on finding water. What have you found so far that might suggest anything about water?
Oh, so that's really fascinating. So JWST gives us access to water emission lines. So essentially, JWST provides us not only with those beautiful images that we've seen, but also spectroscopy. So spectra are actually the most popular thing that astronomers request on the telescope. So this is where we spread out the light into its, you know, different parts, different colors, and individual molecules can produce lines that we can identify their fingerprints by. And so there are a number of water lines in the near and the mid-infrared that people can use to characterize water. And there have been a number of really interesting results, particularly in what are called protoplanetary disks. So these are nascent forming planetary systems. They're in the process of forming their giant planets, but they haven't quite formed them yet. And people have looked at these systems and they find water and organics in them, which gives us clues as to like where is the water when the planets are forming.
So as we mentioned in the intro, the James Webb, and it's funny how quickly you can say the acronym, JWST, is a million miles away. It's at what's called the second Lagrange point, or L2. And I have always seen that, and I have wondered how what this name created, the second Lagrange point. What does it mean?
Right. So a Lagrange point is a stable gravitational point where essentially things won't move around too much, right? So if we think about the configuration of like our Earth and Sun and Moon, right, each of them has exerts gravity on objects around it. And so the Lagrange 2 point is special because it's a place where you can put the telescope and it won't, for example, like, you know, be gravitationally tugged too hard on something and wander off from a different to a different location. So the Lagrange 2 point in particular is special because for JWST, we get backgrounds that are a little bit different from backgrounds for visual telescopes like Hubble. So we actually have a problem with heat. And so heat from the sun and heat from the moon create backgrounds that make it hard to see very deeply into the universe. And so JWST has a sun shield that's attached to it, and it uses it to block out heat from nearby objects. And so what's special about the Lagrange 2 point is that's a place where you can go that essentially that the moon and the Earth and the sun are essentially all lined up. So you can use your sun shield to block out the light from all those objects at once and point the telescope the other way. So you're looking into the coldest, darkest parts and get the most sensitive measurements.
Well, we mentioned in the intro that July 12th is the second anniversary of the launch of James Webb. I'm going to stick with James Webb instead of the acronym. And one of the things NASA has done on July 12th is release, and great, this is great for radio, I understand, one of the most amazing images I think you've produced of two interacting galaxies. And we will post a link to these images for our listeners. But tell us a bit about this amazing image.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous image. And as you said, that it shows two galaxies that are close enough that they're actually interacting with one another. So they first passed by each other about 25 to 75 million years ago. And we really expect that they're going to continue to do this cosmic dance back and forth for millions of years to come. So if you look at the picture, the galaxy, the larger one on the right, it's called the Penguin, and it actually used to be a spiral galaxy, just like our own Milky Way. And what happened is when it passed close to the galaxy on the left, which is called the Egg, it became wildly distorted. If you look very closely at the Penguin and at its eye, that's actually what used to be the center of the galaxy. And if you look at the structures that make up the beak and the back, those actually used to be its spiral arms, and it's been unwound through this interaction with the galaxy on the left. So really, spiral galaxies are a little bit delicate, and they can be easily torn apart when they encounter other galaxies. So the galaxy on the left, which has been called the Egg, it's an elliptical galaxy, and it's hard to tell, but it's actually relatively dense, like a cannonball. And so it's difficult for it to change its shape even as it's interacting with the penguin.
Well, as you look at the image, there is another galaxy far off to the right at the top right corner. And it's amazing how when we look at images, we see the images maybe flat and maybe that they're all close to one another. But tell us what that other galaxy is and really how far away is it from those other two that are interacting, and will it actually come in and play along?
Yeah, so that's the great thing about astronomy, is that when you're looking at the sky, you're seeing sort of two-dimensionally, like space that's three-dimensional. So we don't have, just when we look at the picture, any information about distance. So that galaxy that's in the top right corner, that's actually much, much closer than the one that's the interacting galaxies that you see. And you can't tell that just because they appear to be close on the image. So that means that the third galaxy won't ever interact with the other two. One of the ways that we can tell that the galaxies are different is by looking at different wavelengths, different, you know, the visual that our eyes see, the infrared, the longer wavelengths that are most are associated with heat. And that galaxy in the top right corner drops out at the longer wavelengths. And so that's one of the reasons that we know that it's closer.
For our listeners, if you're listening right now and you would like to know what we're talking about, you can go online to science.nasa.gov/mission and you'll find the latest images. And I'm here to tell you that as soon as you click on one that does look like a penguin. I mean, it looks just like a penguin. That's what we're talking about. So, Dr. Chan, I was just wondering, as you were talking about the penguin galaxy and the other galaxy that it's interacting with. So the penguin galaxy is a spiral galaxy. You said our galaxy is the same, and you mentioned that it can unravel, making me think it's less stable, I guess. Is that a correct depiction? I mean, it's kind of scary then if our galaxy can unravel.
Yeah, I think that's true, that it's more delicate than the elliptical galaxy is. And so that's why it can be unraveled and distorted into this geometry. So if you think about the Milky Way, we actually have satellite galaxies, little tiny galaxies that you can see from the southern hemisphere called the Magellanic Clouds. And they're actually infalling into the Milky Way. And one day they'll crash into the Milky Way too. And when they do so, they'll trigger star formation. But they're much smaller. And so I don't think they're expected to distort the Milky Way in quite the same way that the penguin's been distorted. And the time scales for these things to happen are very, very long. So it certainly won't be in any of our lifetimes. It'll be, you know, probably billions of years from now.
Right, right. So when the James Webb shows that galaxies are interacting, what are some of the things that this tells you about their evolution?
Absolutely. So one of the main pathways for galaxies to evolve is actually through interactions. One of the key discoveries from the Hubble Space Telescope, you know, more than 30 years ago now, was that when you look at the very distant universe, the galaxies that you see there are small and irregular. And so, you know, people have really been trying to understand, how do you get from those small and irregular galaxies that you see then to the ones that we see today, and even what's even further back in time. But astronomers believe that it's the merger, the interaction of galaxies that get us from the ones that we see in the distant universe to the ones today. Particularly elliptical galaxies, we know, are created by mergers of other galaxies.
So we've been speaking with the people from the Nancy Grace Roaming Space Telescope, and I know they're getting ready to launch. How are you guys planning on interacting with one another, and how do those missions support each other?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're very complementary missions. So Nancy Grace Space Telescope is about the same size as Hubble Space Telescope, and they operate in very similar wavelengths. What makes them distinctive is their fields of view. So the Roman telescope has a much wider field of view than Hubble does. And so it can look at much larger areas of the sky at the same time. And indeed, one of its sort of mandates is to like map the sky repeatedly and to try to understand how things in the universe are changing. As we've been going on in time, we've been learning that the sky is not static. I think astronomers typically assume that, you know, things don't change very much because human lifetimes are very short. And so the probability that you see something like, you know, changing is probably small. But as we've been like watching objects over time, you know, now for 20, 30 years within the infrared, we've actually seen that they change their brightness. And so this is a key axis to try to understand is the time domain, how things change over time. So that's one area that Roman will explore, which is complementary to Hubble. It's also test bedding some new equipment. It's test bedding these advanced coronagraphs in space. So the idea here with a coronagraph is that you block out light from the central star. You know, imagine sticking your thumb over the sun, and that's kind of what a coronagraph originally was, to look at faint things around that object. It's a testbed for future instrumentation that will go on the next generation of telescopes. So one of the results of the Astronomers Decadal Survey in 2020, so this is recommendations from the astronomical community about what's exciting to do next, is, you know, essentially to take the spectrum of an exo-Earth to understand really what its atmosphere looks like. And one of the technologies that we need for that is one of these coronagraphs to enable spectroscopy at visual wavelengths.
But when we go online as civilians, we see these beautiful images with color and depth and just vivid. But what do you see? I picture you downloading this image from James Webb. Here comes this beautiful image, updated image of the pillars of creation. But I'm guessing it doesn't quite look like that. What do you get in your data, and how do you transform this into what we see?
Sure. So with images, I think one of the most notable aspects of the JWST images is that when you look at any picture, you see galaxies everywhere. And this is just absolutely amazing compared to before James Webb Space Telescope. So essentially what you're able to do is see into the distant universe. With Hubble Space Telescope, they originally took something called the Hubble Deep Field in 1996, where they stared at the same point in the sky for 2 weeks. To try to see like back as far as possible as they could in time. And essentially, one of the things that's remarkable to me about any of these images is that they're all filled with distant galaxies. And so you only need hours to do what Hubble used to, you know, it used to take Hubble weeks, 2 weeks to do the same sort of thing because of, you know, the large aperture and the infrared capability. So it's been spectacular. For me, and I think a lot of other astronomers, I'm really interested, again, in spectroscopy. So again, spreading out the light to see what things are made out of. One of the things that I really love about mid-infrared spectroscopy is the ability to see features from dust and to understand what the dust is made out of. So for example, if you go to the Greensand Beach in Hawaii, it's covered in olivine. So if your birthstone is peridot, it's the same thing. But the Greensand Beach is green because it's covered in olivine crystals. And so we can find olivine, you know, in young planetary systems by taking their spectra and seeing the fingerprints of olivine there. And so we can learn a lot about the detailed composition of the dust and its properties and really understand how the planetary systems are forming and evolving.
It's really interesting, Christine, when you look at the Pillars of Creation image. You know, I know sometimes we try to connect science and religion, but it really looks like someone who comes from a religious background would call that the hand of God for sure, because that's what it looks like. You know, it looks like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really, really amazing. I wanted to ask you about when you, as an astronomer, like you talk about the beach in Hawaii and you make this connection from space to what you see here on Earth, how often does that happen to you? Can you just talk about that a little bit, how often you can make those connections?
Yeah, I think for me, like, that's my overarching question is, like, you know, how common or rare are planets like our own? And what is the potential for life in the universe, right? So I think that's the thing that really gets me excited is trying to imagine alien worlds and, you know, how lonely is it out there, right? And so I'm super excited to make these observations because they're really telling us about, you know, we look at individual planetary systems and see where they are in the course of their formation. And we think we know a lot about how our solar system formed and evolved by looking at, for example, the asteroids, comets, the configuration of the solar system planets. And I'm just really curious, like, did the same things happen around other solar systems, other planetary systems, or not? To really get at this question, like, how common is, you know, a planetary system like our own, and how common is life in the universe?
We have been speaking with Dr. Christine Chen. She is an astronomer with the James Webb Space Telescope Science Institute. And one just question I always love to ask as we wrap up with young, especially female scientists, how did you get into this? And, you know, maybe just give us a little overview of your education.
Sure. So I grew up in a scientific household. My dad was a scientist. And I remember in 1986 going out to see Halley's Comet and driving down Ortega Highway in California and pulling off to the side and like seeing everybody out looking at the comet with their binoculars and telescopes. And it was really inspiring for me. I knew from an early age that I wanted to do science. And I chose to go to a science-oriented college. I went to Caltech as an undergraduate. And there I really decided astronomy was super cool and I wanted to pursue that. And so I went on to graduate school and I got my PhD in astronomy from UCLA.
That sounds perfect, just perfect. I love that. And it's my hope that since we've had all of these brushes with eclipses recently and we have this wonderful astronomy festival in Bryce Canyon National Park, and that a lot of young people will get turned on just like you. Dr. Christine Chen, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.